You're listening to Sunday Brunch, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2019 on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, what do artists do all day and how do they keep their work fresh? As a new exhibition looks at the routines of their lives, we'll try to answer those questions. We'll also look at how you match up dance and music.
I'm about to go out there with 73 musicians who are sitting in the dark, facing the wrong way, reacting via me to a stage full of people who are hopefully in perfect synchrony. You try not breaking a sweat.
Will also help you to be happy, seriously. Plus,
after a time, their presence becomes incredibly real and you start practicing keeping still. And you stand very still. Then the public comes in and you keep standing very still and they come right up to you and they comment on how realistic you are. And then you just say to them very quietly, hello.
We'll find out how the man who used to work with Madame Tussaud's famous mannequins brings their creator to life. Plus, we'll take a detailed look through the weekend's papers, all in the next hour on this Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. And there's lots more in the news as well this morning. For example, British MPs may well not get their half-term holiday, which is something that may cheer the many millions of people who are wondering why they need a half-term holiday. It appears they're a little bit busy, and an extra 5 days will certainly resolve all of the issues around Brexit. That's one of the stories in this morning's papers. We'll explore more of those when we look through the newspapers in around half an hour's time. But we'll start today with a question which I suspect is a lot harder to answer than you may imagine. What does an artist do all day? If your job is to be creative, how do you summon that creativity? Especially if, like most of us, you have to juggle it with all the other responsibilities of a daily life. A new exhibition, which has opened in the last few days here in London, explores the ideas of daily practice and repeated routine and how that affects art. It's been curated by Dr. Henry Ward, who is the creative director of the Freelands Foundation and is with me in the studio, along with two of the artists who are featured in the exhibition, Nikki Brittenfield and Joseph Cartwright. Henry, let me start with you, if I may. I mentioned there the Freelands Foundation. Tell me a little more about it first.
Okay, so the Freelands Foundation was set up just over 4 years ago. It was founded by Liz Murdoch. It's a philanthropically funded foundation. And the sort of interest of the foundation really is in supporting artists and art education. So we're a grant-giving foundation, but we're also setting up our own programmes. So we have a base in London, which we moved into just under a year ago in Chalk Farm, which is where the exhibition takes place. And we're looking at working with, as I say, supporting artists in arts education, and that's been under a number of things. Obviously, it's a massively wide remit. So slowly over the last 4 years, that's been refined. With artists, it's about, we've got a big interest in the UK from a national perspective, so particularly outside of London. With arts education, we've had a big focus on secondary teachers, particularly supporting secondary teachers. But we're really interested in asking questions about how art gets made, why art gets made, how we can support artists in experimenting with approaches to that, and so on.
And you mentioned there about secondary teachers. I know that there's a lot of concern in the UK that art is one of those subjects that gets squeezed in schools now, partly because of the focus on academic results, partly because of the financial pressures.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, we're in a kind of really trying time for arts education at the moment in the country. There's enormous kind of concern about how it's being stripped back in the curriculum at secondary level, at primary level, but even actually in tertiary education as well, the kind of academisation of the arts curriculum, the sort of amalgamation of art colleges into universities as faculties, and the sort of homogenisation of the way in which things are taught. So we are, I think, we're in danger as a society at the moment of kind of forgetting something we're really good at, actually.
Let's talk a little bit about the show. I mentioned there that it looks at daily routines that people have in their lives and how that impacts on creativity. Tell me a little more about it.
So the original idea for the exhibition was to look at exactly that. It was about how artists might find ways of making work that was repetitive. So often when we think about creativity or we think about artistic practice in a very sort of broad way, we think about this idea of being innovative and doing something different. But very often when you look at the way artists make work, they often repeat themselves again and again. Even in artists who are making quite different work, you see these sort of repetitive patterns. So I was interested in looking at artists that did things the same way, perhaps, or repeated themselves. So one of the artists in the exhibition is a 84-year-old painter called Peter Dreher, who's a German painter. He's the professor emeritus at Karlsruhe University, and he began painting an empty glass of water in his studio in 1974. He's gone on to paint the same glass of water 5,000 times. And what's interesting about that is that they're, in a sense, they're the same, but they're also completely different. And so how does repeating something could give you space to be quite creative. But then as the exhibition developed and I started talking to different artists about the work they were making, other themes kind of edged in. So this idea about how maybe repetitive practice enables you to be creative in the face of responsibility, whether that's a job or occupation, or whether that's, in lots of cases, domestic responsibility. So how parenting might feature. There's a cliche that the enemy of art is the pram in the hall, but actually, very often when you talk to artists about how they juggle parenting and artistic practice, the role of the parent can impact in an interesting way.
Well, we have two of the artists who are involved in this exhibition with me in the studio. Joseph, how do those other responsibilities impact on you?
Well, I agree with Henry. I mean, my practice is defined really by the space I have in between my responsibilities. So I'm a full-time teacher. I've got three boys, and I'm kind of very happily married. So yeah, I've got all those kind of responsibilities. But between the drop-offs and pick-ups of various kind of sporting fixtures and extra maths and English classes, I find that time, maybe it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, to actually have a look around. I might find myself in an odd situation. I drive my son to various hockey matches, and we were in Essex yesterday, somewhere that I hadn't been before. So that opens up a whole new kind of variety of visual experiences that I can capture with a camera, through photography. So that all kind of ties into that kind of construct of I'm having to do something else, but between those spaces, I can actually look and be visually articulate, I suppose.
Nikki, that is something that I think a lot of people who aren't involved in art would find a bit strange, that idea that you might have a 10-minute window. The perception a lot of people would have is, oh, sort of artists have got all day, haven't they, to sort of sit around and think about things. But actually, they've got the same things to do as everybody else.
Yeah, I think so. I think I often find myself a lot of the time not making, but thinking about what I might make. And that often happens in those 10-minute windows you have when you're just sitting waiting for a train or whatever it might be. That's the majority of the practice is, for me, happens through the time I get to spend thinking about the making rather than the actual making. For example, the piece of work I've got in the show, Repeat, Repeat, I've tied a knot into a cotton thread, one knot per day, for the past 6 years since I started training to become a teacher. And the act of tying the knot actually only takes a matter of seconds. And I just do that once a day, and that fulfills part of my desire to be creative, if you like, even though it only takes a few seconds. And then the majority of the, as an artist, as a practitioner, is spent thinking in them small windows, really.
Henry, that there is a conflict, maybe, isn't there, between a profession, or I don't know if profession is the right word, but a choosing a life that is fundamentally about creativity. And you explore that idea, someone who's done the same painting of a glass of water 5,000 times. You say each one of those is different and the inspiration behind it is different, the where they are when they do it is different. But there's a fundamental conflict, isn't there, between, on the one hand, wanting to live this life that is about creativity and about, as you say, about thinking and about exploring things. But then at the same time, I sound like everybody else. There are bills to pay. There are children to be picked up from school. There are things that need doing around the house. That fence isn't going to build itself, those kind of things. Which, now, do they get in the way, or are they actually helpful?
I think they get in the way and they're helpful, actually. I think in both cases, I think that there's there is a conflict, but maybe being given maybe if as an artist one had space and time and limitless resources, that would be more problematic. I think often real genuine creativity comes out of overcoming obstacles and kind of meeting challenges, and that in some way sort of restrictions aren't necessarily a bad thing. I think that often artists, you know, perhaps the perception of an artist is that they, I think, as you started at the beginning saying, you know, they sort of sit around all day waiting to be creative. But I think that in a way something, you know, Nikki's just said about that kind of 10-minute wait for a train or having to fit something in, or as Joseph's saying about being open to experiences of where you are and responding to them. I think that in some way sort of having restrictions on your time forces you to be more creative, and sometimes limits on materials, limits on what you can do, forces more creativity. So it would be very easy to see, you know, being a parent or having to do a job, or the, as you say, putting up a shelf or whatever it happens to be in your life, as being something that is in the way of being creative. But maybe it's about a frame you put around it, a state of mind that makes you question things and look at things in a different kind of way. And I think for a lot of artists, it's a compulsion to make. And so you find that space to make things within the circumstances and context that you find yourself in.
And Joseph, you mentioned before the idea that you would have 5 or 10 minutes to notice something in a new part of the country because you're driving your son to a hockey game. In any job, however much somebody may love what they do, there will be a point where they start to feel a bit disenchanted by it or a bit bored by it, or wanting to find a new way to do it. Is that, in a way, having those little 10-minute windows, finding inspiration in places you didn't expect to be, a way that helps you to keep it all a bit sort of fresh in your own mind?
Well, I think I know. Absolutely. I mean, in a previous life, I was a printer, and I used to have a week on, week off, and I had a studio, and I wasn't very productive. I'm much more productive now because I realise that time is kind of precious, and, you know, I haven't got time to prevaricate because everything needs to be done at some time very quickly, you know. So that really does help, you know, to produce, I suppose. I think what Henry was saying is this idea there's a compulsion to make. There is a compulsion to make, but with that, with those very limited time schedules, then that becomes easier to produce work.
And Nikki, I know you're doing some teaching, aren't you, in the south of England? Again, do you come away from that having found it really helpful, that it's given you some, the contact you've had with other people has given you some inspiration, or is it a thing that it's like, oh, I've got to do this thing, and then I can get on with what I want to do?
No, I think it's absolutely the former. I think all three of us at some point have been in a privileged position of having been able to be an art teacher. And through that, I speak to myself, but I'm sure it's the same for Henry and Joseph, that there's numerous opportunities on a daily basis to be creative and to share ideas and to be selective of what ideas you choose to share with students and explore with students collaboratively. As well as some ideas that presumably we as artists choose not to share but to keep for ourselves.
I think absolutely, and I think picking up on that, again, that comes back to this idea of state of mind. It's about, you know, if you're going to teach art, there are fantastic examples of artists who were brilliant artists and brilliant teachers but found that relationship between those two things hugely problematic, that in a sense giving away too much to students left nothing for themselves. But then there are other brilliant examples of artists who've been fantastic teachers and seen that relationship as being symbiotic, that every aspect of what they did becomes part of their practice. And I think that there is there's a way in which artists can embrace those other aspects of their lives, whether that be teaching or whether it be the other things we touched on, like domesticity and so on, that the domestic responsibility, all of these things can feed into your practice. So I do think it's about a state of mind, and you know what Joseph was saying there about the pressure of sometimes the pressure of time fitting something into a tiny window, but that compulsion to make you do something and you're productive with it. And I think that similarly, you know, in periods of my life where I've had perhaps more time than I have now to make, I've made less. But you know, that pressure on, I've really got to do this, I've got to get something out there, I want to make something, and tiny little windows are much more productive.
Well, it's fascinating. Thank you all three of you for coming in to talk about it this morning. Very much appreciated. Repeat, Repeat is on at the Freelands Foundation in North London. It started a few days ago. It is on until the 2nd of March this year. Henry Ward, Nikki Brittenfield. Thank you very much, Joseph. Thank you all for coming in this morning. Still to come on Sunday Brunch today, we'll give you some advice on how to stay happy in January, even though there's only a few days left. And the story of Madame Tussaud revealed. Do stay with us.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Well, next we're going to talk about Gavin Sutherland, a conductor and composer who was appointed the music director of the English National Ballet in 2008, 2 years later becoming principal conductor. He knows a thing or two about matching up music and dance. But how does the music used with dance differ from music made to perform? Well, Gavin spoke to Monocle's Emma Nelson. He started by explaining how his own journey into music began.
I started playing the piano at the age of 3. So my version of the internet was people discarding their record collections and sitting with my Dansette record player and listening to anything and everything I could lay my hands on. And teachers and friends would recommend various things for me to listen to, and I gorged on it all. At the age of 11, I was asked to go and play for Miss Lewis's dancing school in the small Durham town of Chesterley Street.
So we have a lot to... So Miss Lewis has an awful lot to answer for from
this really point. Does. So I started playing there until I was 18 and went off to university. And I learned about the steps. I learned about the nature of ballet. Not so much about the repertoire, although we did go and see some performances by various companies that visited Newcastle or Sunderland. And
I'm just thinking about little Gavin, clearly into music and into classical
crawler,
music.
An absolute crawler.
And all his mates are growing up and getting into what? Into football, this, that and the other. And then there's little Gavin going, actually, no, I quite fancy a bit of Giselle, thank you very much.
Indeed.
What was that like for you?
Very strange. With all my friends growing up, knowing they're going to be factory fodder, knowing they're going into engineering, shipbuilding, the pits still at that time, I did not want to be within a million miles of that. And my parents, because they weren't musicians, I wasn't born of a musical family. We appreciated it, but we didn't really appreciate the same kinds of music. I suppose ultimately I was doomed to be different. So I got to 18 and little Gavin decided he wanted to go and extend his musical education. My parents wanted me to be a music teacher because that was a solid job. I didn't want to be a teacher. I really did not want to be a teacher. I didn't even know what being a conductor was like, although I made my first conducting appearance aged 11 with a local operatic society. And that was a joy in itself because these dear ladies of a certain age sitting there and I'm trying to teach them a musical called Bless the Bride and saying, sopranos, you know, you're singing an E flat, it's an E natural, and they're all sat there, arms folded, isn't he lovely? Isn't he lovely? I go, but you're singing the wrong note. And then you get, don't you talk to me like that, young man, I know your dad. So, you know, I was dealing with adults and an adult life and an adult lifestyle from far too early an age. So I guess the maturity of knowledge I had with regards to music was also slightly skewed, and thus finding out more about ballet, finding out more about dance. When I got to 18, I thought, okay, I can put that on a shelf and say I've done that now. I had no idea it was going to become the mainstay of my musical career for 27 years as a result.
How did you make it happen?
In the second year at university, my conducting teacher was a wonderful man called John Longstaff, and he was instrumental in taking me to a ballet company called Northern Ballet. They were on the hunt for pianists who could sight read and who had an idea what ballet class was. So I went there, and within 4 or 5 weeks, I was playing regularly for them whilst keeping up my university studies. How? I don't know. Boundless energy? No idea. Fear, probably. Then a short time after that, I was playing in the orchestra and then conducting. And my first outing as a ballet conductor was on the 28th of April, 1992, doing a matinee of Romeo and Juliet at the Theatre Royal in Nottingham.
That's pretty big stuff. It's a massive score.
It's a massive score, and I had good support from the music director of the company, John Price Jones, and John Longstaff, and the orchestra, who were very, very kind and supportive, and the dancers. Now, this was a totally new regime for me. Dancers and dancers' requirements, demands, what they say is, I would like this to be just the same as it's always been with every conductor I've ever done it with in the past. I don't know any of them. I know this piece as I know it, and I've watched you do it. And then somehow I got in the pit and I responded to the dancers, responded to their needs and their wishes, and the orchestra seemed happy with the contact they were receiving. So it was a generally good collaboration.
How do you manage all these people? It starts to become less about the music and more about sort of corporate psychology.
It's fascinating because dancers are... There's this common thing of ego. Ultimately, we are all small people trying to give a big performance to a big audience. And, you know, I feel that. I always consider myself very humble in what I do, but I enjoy it so much. So if it comes out like it looks like I have an ego, that's up to people to decide. But dancers are the same, ultimately. You then learn the language they speak. For example, a dancer will say to me, well, everything was too slow today. Can I have everything quicker, please? Quantify that phrase, everything, with the intervals, you know, the bits where you're not on stage? Or do you actually mean there was one step where you felt you were in the air for a little bit too long and that coloured your judgment of the rest of the show that you're going to be wrong?
Now, and how do you deal with that?
You say, you know what? You're absolutely right. Let's make it better the next time, and I'll keep an eye out for that. And sometimes you go on and do precisely the same thing as you did before, and it's fine. I consider myself a conduit. I stand at that pit door and have done for all these years, and I could run a mile. I could run 1,000 miles in the other direction because I'm about to go out there with 73 musicians who are sitting in the dark, facing the wrong way, reacting via me to a stage full of people who are hopefully in perfect synchrony doing traditional choreography that's been around for hundreds of years in a technique that's been around the same amount of time. You try not breaking a sweat in a situation like that. And one of my interesting ones is, in our company, our artistic director, Tamara Rojo, is still dancing. So imagine that you're conducting your boss. She's front and centre stage. She's 8 feet away from you, looking right at you for all the support she needs as a dancer, but you're also processing the fact that she is your boss.
when you're in there and you think, OK, I've got my boss on stage, I've got 73 musicians, I'm going too fast or too slowly, depending on who I'm working with. Oh, and by the way, we're dusting off a score that we've been playing for years, and there's high expectations. How do you keep everybody interested and inspired?
It's your sense of smell. It's your sense of wonderment and rediscovery. Because let's not forget that one of our members of the orchestra has been playing there for 51 years in our orchestra. That's quite something in a company that's been going almost 70 years now. He's been there since the late 60s. So these people have seen Nutcracker far more than I have and far more than I ever will. So to keep them on board, as well as people who are coming into play for the first time, as well as the audience, some of whom are coming to see multiple performances of it or have seen it year on year, all these things stack up in my mind. And I have to go on and make everything coherent, interesting, and as theatrically well-paced and entertaining as possible for everybody. Doing that for dancers in Nutcracker is quite easy because of how sectional it is. And Act One is like a massive tone poem. So it's like a 50-minute continuous piece of music that develops, written by one of the greatest romantic symphonists of the 19th and 20th centuries. So you're in safe hands there. Equally, you're at the mercy of the production you're doing. And of course, there have been hundreds of productions of Nutcracker over the years. Ours is quite a unique one. It's quite a steady one, tempo-wise, but also it's quite a well-balanced Nutcracker in terms of entertainment for audiences young and old. So we've got the audience on side. Now, the plot. Now, the Hoffman story's been taken considerable liberties with over the years, and musically, Tchaikovsky did the same. So you have to make sure that the drama is well expressed and there's no eggy pauses where, you know, you hear a polite cough in the audience, like thinking, what's for tea? And, you know, all these things go through people's minds. Then you have to remember that the dancers are not just doing one performance for one set of audience. They're doing 23 consecutive ones. And some years we've done 40, 45 performances, and I've done quite a lot of those with them. I lose myself in creation of the music. I know I have to make concessions to the dancers, but I lose myself in the music. And as long as I lose myself in the music on everybody's terms, the choreographers, the dancers, the orchestras, Tchaikovsky's, the audience's terms, as long as I make those five concessions, then I can enjoy myself. And if not, I'll be standing outside selling chips.
That's Gavin Sutherland speaking to Emma Nelson. Gavin performing next in Chicago from the 28th of February. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Time now for this week's Weekend Read. Our subject today is Edward Carey. His latest book is called Little. It explores revolutionary Paris through the fictionalized eyes of the orphan who grew up to become Madame Tussaud. The book took 15 years to write, and Emma Nelson asked why it took so long.
It's been every size. It was 700 pages at one point, then it went down to 200. I just couldn't quite work out how to work it out, and I did loads and loads of research. And all the novels I'd written before are set in sort of cities and countries that don't exist. But France exists, apparently, and the French Revolution happened. And so I got a big bogged down in the research, and then I stopped it. I actually abandoned the book and thought I would never, ever go back to it. And I felt happier, and then I couldn't leave it. And I love Marie Tussaud so much. I think she's such an amazing character. I went back to it. And finally finished it.
So what was it that actually drew you in the first place to documenting the life of a woman who whose name has become synonymous with an enormous tourist destination in the United Kingdom, a place in which you actually work.
It was working there. In my early 20s, after I left university and had no prospects, I got a job at Madame Tussauds. And it was a very strange job. I was stopping people from harming the waxworks. And actually, the longer I was there, the more respect I had for the waxworks. You end up having tremendous sympathy for them. And then the public comes in and they're kind of rude to the waxworks. They get very close to them. And it's this kind of strange thing that we have actually distance between human beings. But if it's a waxwork, a person just gets right on top of it.
So were you attributing a little bit too much life to these
One of the things when you're there, when you're working there, actually, you do twice a day at least alone with them in a room with a wax populace. And after a time, their presence becomes incredibly real and you start practicing keeping still. And you stand very still. Then the public comes in and you keep standing very still and they come right up to you and they comment on how realistic you are. And then you just say to them very quietly, hello. And they scream. And that was one of the things we did. But there was something about actually keeping still, the whole business of we're moving around so much as human beings, actually, the business of it keeping still. They have some incredible dignity, the waxworks. But it was working there, I started to understand actually who Marie Tussaud was, that she had the most astounding life and that she went through the French Revolution and that she was in Versailles and that she was tutor to Louis XVI's sister Elizabeth and that she cast Marie Antoinette and people from life, the whole body, and then she cast them fractioned. Their heads after they'd been guillotined. So these are people she knew that she had their heads in her lap. She had blood in her lap. And she seemed that wherever she went, she met famous people. She couldn't but help it. So she was imprisoned and very nearly guillotined during the terror of Robespierre. And the person in her cell with her was Josephine, Napoleon's future empress. So they were in prison, you know, together. And wherever she went, she touched you. Franklin, Voltaire, you know, the most incredible people. She knew all these people. And she survived the French Revolution she would have been guillotined, but the terror came to an end. And she was let out of prison so that she could cast the head stump of Robespierre after he'd been guillotined. So her life was just amazing. And she was a small, tiny, 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 tiny woman. And what seemed to me so amazing is she's vulnerable. She's a foreigner. She's born in Switzerland. And to be Swiss in that time was very, very dangerous. Because Swiss guards fired on the populace. They protected the king. And Swiss people were being guillotined just for being Swiss. But she survived all this. And she had history. She made history in three dimensions. And then she bought history across the channel. She packed up the French Revolution in nice crates, brought it across the road to Baker Street, to the Marylebone Road, and opened the boxes and just could say to English people, here, this is the French Revolution.
What's astonishing is her beginnings. You mentioned the fact that she's born in Switzerland, but you document the life of a little girl who has everything go against her. She loses her father. She loses her mother. She is then, however, placed in the care of a man called Dr. Curtius, and everything changes. And there is this astonishing moment when she walks into this man's scientific, laboratory, as we would describe it now, and sees wax tongues and body parts. And it is an astonishing thing because this is how old a little girl? She's five, six years old. Now, I don't know what the effect would be on an average child of that age would be to see a room full of dissected body parts. But for her, a spark is lit, isn't it?
Yeah, I think she was fascinated by everything human. I think any human being, every part of a human being was fascinating to her. And Curtius was a genius, a medical wax anatomist. And that's, he made the insides of a human. And then he became famous for making the outsides of doing the famous people. Because he was so good, he realized that he could have a career sculpting famous people, and this is what he did in Paris. But I think the thing about Tussaud, I think the thing about going to the museum is that she was fascinated by humanity, and I think that museum is actually a temple to physiognomy. And you go in and you can see every different kind of shape of human being, and it's something kind of incredible. But she cast the heads that people were interested in. So it was the best of the world, and it was absolute worst. It was murderers and kings, or, philosophers. Let's not necessarily put the monarchy up there as the best. But she knew that, and I think she was equally fascinated sculpting the head of Voltaire or Rousseau as she was with a guillotine stump. And not just guillotine stumps, but hacked off heads were delivered to her after the storming of the Bastille. These weren't, neatly severed. These were hacked by the mob.
How was it trying to combine this, frankly, almost unbelievable story of this young girl turns into woman that you describe, but also telling an emotional story of a little girl growing up? I mean, there's a moment in the book where she's just lost her mother, and she's obviously lost because everything that she has ever known has now gone. And then she realises that she has the same nose as her mother. And then that says, OK, well, love can continue through the recognition of body parts. I mean, how hard a job was it for you to bring those two narratives together?
I think it took the hardest part was actually reconciling the horror of that life and actually finding love in it, as you say. And that was actually to make her feel like a real person, and not to make her feel uncanny, not to make her feel like a kind of monster, but a loving, I think she's a deeply loving human being. She describes herself as being at the level of people's hearts when she stands up. And I feel like that's kind of who she is. She was so fascinated. But, working at Madame Tussauds, the best waxwork in Madame Tussauds is Madame Tussaud herself. She sculpted herself as a woman in old age, and the face is, you look at it, I stood next to her every day, and you just can't help but going, wow, you are amazing. And there's no doubt that she's a proprietor. She's in charge of this place. This tiny little woman in kind of terrifying Victorian bombazine black, who kind of looks over everybody. But she's like a piece of folktale. She's like a fairy tale. She's like the kind of Baba Yaga of the waxworks. And you just look at her and you just go, oh, my heavens, she's a mythical person.
So why did you choose to write from her point of view? Because you're clearly, you get the impression that you're rather in awe of this tiny woman who led this remarkable life, yet you decided to write it from her point of view. That's quite a brave step.
Well, or maybe foolish. It's taken me 15 years to get there, but I wanted her voice. It was her figure, just seeing it every day, and just getting into just thinking of her life and actually what she experienced. And as she walked around, she cast this wonderful waxwork of herself. She would walk around it and sit next to it, so it'd be Madame Tussaud beside herself. And I think she was just so, she was so smart and kind of fun too, but she had all this past to her, so it had to be her voice. It couldn't be anybody else's voice. And so that we have a personal life from her, because the thing with Marie Tussaud is also, we don't know how much of what she said of her life is 100% true. She knew what made a great story, but some of it is exaggerated. But we know that the French Revolution, actually one of the big key moments, that 2 days before the storming of the Bastille, were Curtius's wax heads were stolen by a mob and marched through these were key politicians' busts that were taken, and the mob was attacked by Louis XVI soldiers and shot, and the wax heads were broken. And that, 2 days later, was one of the powder kegs that led to the Bastille.
And that's Edward Carey speaking about that book called Little, which is out now. Don't forget, there's a full back catalogue of all the past editions of Meet the Writers available at monocle.com. Stay with us. In just a moment, we'll take a look through the weekend's papers.
Perk up and tackle Monocle's Fit February issue. This is an essential guide for those looking to get in fighting shape for 2019. First up, we take a look at the people leading the way in whittling their nation's waistlines from Qatar to Tonga to Norway. On to the business section, where we sit down with Airbus's CEO to talk about what's in store for aviation, before checking out the company's streamlining and speeding up deliveries. In culture, we meet Rome's top art restorers, and in design, we touch down in Parma to meet OLAB, the smart architecture firm that's transformed a palace into a sleek hotel. Monocle's February issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Time to take a look through some of the stories in the weekend's newspapers now. My guest in the studio this week is the journalist and author Terry Stiassny. Thank you very much for coming in. We're going to start with Brexit because it's another big week.
Yet another one.
I mean,
yes.
I don't know how. Well, I mean, it depends on how many weeks there are to the end of March, I suppose. There are many more big weeks to come. But for such a big week, we're surprisingly light on big stories on Brexit in the papers today.
Yes, it's interesting. There is a sort of a slight, you know, Groundhog Day feel, maybe to the whole thing, maybe just to the Sunday papers this morning. I mean, it does make the front page of the main British papers in a variety of ways. So The Observer here has got a lead story about a plan, what they call a mass exodus of businesses from Britain if a no-deal Brexit is allowed to happen. The Sunday Telegraph has a story about Conservative fury about the election watchdog trying to get new powers, and you know, with the possible, you know, prospect of another referendum or more elections or whatever, which again is kind of, you know, a bit niche, let's put it that way. And the Sunday Times, where Tim Shipman, who's written sort of amazingly insider stories of the whole Brexit and election processes, normally can be relied on for some, you know, pretty amazing gossip here. But the best they've got this week is that Philip May, Theresa May's husband, has been reportedly influential behind the scenes in what's going on, which I'm not sure whether that's, you know, it says that reports here says that the Downing Street chief of staff says that Philip May helped to scupper attempts to reach out to Labour MPs, which to me slightly smacks of somebody kind of saying, oh, well, you know, Theresa May, you know, obviously it's her husband really who's kind of getting involved, which I think is a bit patronising.
It's not a newsflash either, is it? So Theresa May is somebody who is known not to really pay that much attention to anybody else.
Yes, she does rely quite strongly on her husband.
There have been stories before, like, when the exit poll came out that the election had gone disastrously wrong 2 years ago, that it was her husband who basically persuaded her not to resign on the spot. I mean, there are all sorts of stories in the past about, surprisingly enough, for a couple who've been married for a long time,
they tend to talk to each other
and
who'd have thought,
rely on each other for emotional support. That doesn't strike me as front page news.
Yeah, it's sort of buried in this story and there's no further details of it. So, meanwhile, you know, Britain is preparing to declare a state of emergency and introduce martial law in the event of disorder after an no-deal
Brexit. Like the kind of thing that ought to be on the front page.
Quite a big story, you'd have thought. I mean, that said, there are a couple of interesting things in here. Also, you know, just not forgetting how this might impact on real people's lives. So The Observer's talked to a few people who've been applying for settled status in the UK, European citizens, so French and Dutch, and other people who've lived in Britain for a long time, who are having, you know, in many cases, real problems with the system, trying to prove that they've lived in Britain long enough, just getting the computer system to work and so on. Also a Dutch person here who grew up, was educated in Britain, but has now moved abroad to Kenya and is wondering whether he's going to be able to have the settled status that would allow him to come back to the UK. And a doctor saying, you know, that he's seen a lot of anxiety, insomnia, panic attacks, heart palpitations. So, you know, this is having a serious effect. And also, the Observer talks to, they've been to the constituency of Yvette Cooper, who's the MP, chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, who's trying to delay this if there's a prospect of no deal, and just talking about the impact that she says there's going to be in her constituency on jobs. So she's got a Haribo factory in her constituency, and saying that they're worried about the availability of Haribo in the UK, and also Burberry. They're worried about jobs, more seriously,
a prospect of Haribo not being around.
Well, you know, there could be, you know,
that could have swung the referendum.
Yes, but as they say, they employ 700 people. You know, they're wondering about what their future is going to be in terms of jobs. She's also got Burberry, which also employs 750 people in a factory in the constituency, and they're again worried about physically making things and
additional measures that they might have to take. So, you know, the serious stuff is all there. Yes, as you say, sort of quite thin news-wise.
Yeah, so very, very big week for Brexit. More votes in Parliament, though presumably we'll get more next week once we know what happens to those. Let's move on to some of the other stories are there instead.
Yeah,
really disturbing one on the front of the Times.
This is a really sad story. We've heard during the week about a 14-year-old girl called Molly Russell who awfully took her own life, and her family are saying that they believe that a lot of the social media websites that she went on before she died may have influenced that. And just telling you about the horrific things that young people are able to find online, particularly like graphic images of self-harm, and obviously, horribly, the way that the algorithms on these sites tend to work is if you start searching for, say, suicide or for self-harm, then they push those images to you more and more. And
rather than, say, the Samaritans.
Well, yes, exactly. So, you know, you'd think that they would say, talk to somebody, some other way of doing this. And, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't understand completely how that works and how you could stop that. And they were saying that there's even been a personalised email sent to Molly's email address a month after she died, from Pinterest, which is like a sort of a scrapbook, you know, photo site, with self-harm images, and the email obviously quoting something from an image that she'd been sent saying, "I can't tell you how many times I wish I was dead."
What's astonishing, that there are a couple of really interesting, like Molly's father's written a piece in the Times talking about this and saying that this brick wall that he then runs into trying to find out what she was reading, partly there is the whole privacy thing that they won't let you into a child's account, even if that child's no longer alive.
Yeah.
But also just the response of companies like Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, which seems to be, look, we know better than you do how to police this network. And you sort of, in the end, you think, this is a company that is basically set up to deliver advertising to people, to which we are now somehow accidentally entrusting it to make moral decisions.
Yes, I mean, it's just because they seem to be saying, some of the companies, that, you know, some of these images do not breach community guidelines. And I know that the companies have tried to make the argument that, you know, oh, well, it depends on the context. But I can't see anything in which the sort of the sight of a slit wrist is not, you know, there's no good context for that. You can't sort of say, you know, I've stopped doing this now. You know, because people are going to look at it in the wrong way. And as you say, maybe there should be some way that, you know, if people are searching for these disturbing things, that they are somehow pointed towards, you know, as you say, places where they can get help, rather than more of the same thing.
Well, government minister also quoted there saying he wants talks with these companies about what they can do to try and help people who may be at risk. Let's take a look at another story, because a lot of newspapers around the world are focused on what's going on in Venezuela.
Yes, and it's not to say completely this is not mentioned by the British papers, but it's just interesting to look at, you know, how much Venezuela is dominating the news in the rest of the world. So the New York Times Weekend International Edition, I like the kind of the snarky opening line from the analysis from Washington. It says, "President Trump has finally met a strong man he does not like." And saying that Trump has drawn a red line with Maduro, and saying their argument here is that this is a sort of a divergence from Trump's America First policy, and to actually suddenly start wanting to take a role of to whatever extent, or to advocating what they call advocating what amounts to regime change in Venezuela is quite different from what Trump has done up until now in many other places. Again, this is a big news for Le Monde in France as well. And they, on their front page, have got an image of the defense minister, the rather excellently named Vladimir Padrino Lopez, who appeared, you know, surrounded by all the chiefs of staff of the military. And on their inside pages, that they're saying that the army has the key to, you know, holds the key to the crisis. And at the moment, so General Vladimir Petrino, the defense minister, was saying he was remaining loyal to Maduro, and he says that we would be unworthy of wearing the uniform if we did not defend the constitution, our independence and our sovereignty. But also in here in Le Monde, they've got an interesting article about Russia and the role of Russia in Maduro's Venezuela, and saying that Putin has called to offer his support, and also just saying quite how much money that Russia has invested in Venezuela. And it says this amounts to $17 billion in the form of investment and credit. So they're saying this is a, you know, so it's kind of interesting the role, you know, how this is going to play out between, you know, the US and Russia both trying to have some influence in Venezuela either way.
Well, indeed, and after many of those newspapers went to press, there has been this meeting at the UN where the US has been telling countries they need to, in their words, pick a side of who they want to support in that. Terry, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Terry Stiesny, looking through some of the weekend's newspapers. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Now, finally today, if you believe the PR people who invented the concept of Blue Monday, last Monday was apparently the most depressing day of the year. This is largely because of the weather, levels of debt, and the time since you got your early pre-Christmas paycheck. It is also, to be honest, a largely fabricated concept designed to get attention for spurious news stories. But it is true that many people do find the first month of the year something of a struggle. Well, Julie Berenson is the owner of We Are Inside Out, whose aim is to teach people to live happier lives. And when she met Monocle's Emma Nelson, she explained how to fix the January blues.
I've always had things like mindfulness and yoga in my life, which came from my granddad, who brought over some of the first Buddhist monks into this country and helped open one of the first Buddhist monasteries, which is Sammy Ling up in Northumberland. Actually, he's got his ashes in the wheel there. So I think from a very young age, I've had a relationship with meditation and the Eastern philosophies, really, which were influenced by him. And he passed away when I was around 10, but a little bit of him has lived on in me, I suppose. And when I was 18, I took myself over to India, to Dharamsala, which was the home of Dalai Lama. And I went and studied little bits of meditation and yoga and got started from there. And then I began teaching it, really, when I was in school and with young children who were 5 years old.
So you put on a yoga DVD, and yeah. What happens to all the little tinies in front of you?
Well, it was quite a surprise because I didn't really think that they would stay so focused and concentrated, but they absolutely loved the movements and they felt a sense of relaxation, actually. I think at the end of my year of teaching them, when I was doing their reports, you know, I said to them, you know, what's the biggest thing that you're taking away from this year, which you might think reading. The majority of them said that they learned to look after their feelings, which I thought was really profound. And it kind of changed my life because it made me realise just how important looking after your feelings is.
Can you explain what looking after your feelings means?
First of all, being able to stop and notice your feelings, that you've got feelings going on and the difference between all of those feelings. And also then I suppose the next step is being aware that sometimes these feelings can be quite overwhelming and can lead you down paths of behaviour that don't really serve you.
Could you give me a quick example there of feeling something and it drags you somewhere that you probably didn't want to go?
I suppose the most obvious one that comes to mind would be anger. So you have that sense someone does something, it makes you feel angry. And before you take time to stop and pause, you might go into an automatic reaction where you just get angry back at them and say some words that are quite hurtful to them and actually aren't really very helpful to the situation.
What do you say to people to help them? What tools can you give us?
Yeah, well, I think what's really important is to just take time for you, for yourself. I think lots of the time, if you're working with families and you're working with parents, is they think, how can we fix, you know, the children? The children need to be fixed. They're causing the stress. And it's this advice that I'm about to give is the same for anyone when you begin to practice mindfulness, is the place that you need to begin is with yourself. And so it's really taking time to notice what's going on in your experience, in your body, and when can you take a little bit of time just to pause and take a few breaths, or just stand and look at some nature, or enjoy a simple cup of tea just to begin that unwinding process.
And that is as simple as that. Look at a tree, have a cup of tea, and maybe it will do what? It won't make the problems go away, but what's the effect on the mind and the body if you just take a little bit of time out?
I mean, the fact of the matter is life is difficult and these problems are going to always be there. What can shift is your relationship with them. And so I think just taking time just to stop and to be and to even just notice your feet on the floor gives a bit of space between a quick reaction that can happen without any thought. And it just gives a tiny bit of space. So maybe you can make a choice, which is a choice to respond to a situation.
One thing I've noticed about London recently mm-hmm. is that it is awash with mindfulness and yeah. it's become an incredibly fashionable thing. Mm. But the people who practice it and who go to regular yoga classes and this, that and the other, they don't necessarily come across as the most patient of people when you see them. I'm talking mainly of, you know, I go to lots of exercise classes where I've got yeah. a bunch of 25-year-old girls who think they're the bee's knees because everything is coming back to them. Mm-hmm. And to a certain degree, some people might argue that having a lot of mindfulness turns you into quite a selfish and egocentric person. Mm. Would yeah. you agree with that?
I'm not going to disagree with what you're saying. I think that because I think there is something that has happened not just in London, but let's say modern Western world, to do with mindfulness, to do with yoga, which is also to do with technology. And in Instagram is the first thing that comes to mind because you see all of these pictures of people trying to make themselves look good. And it's a tricky question to answer because I believe in mindfulness. And I suppose my relationship with it began before it became so popular. And I think the difference is it's your intention, really. It's your intention for what you're wanting to get out of it. If your intention is to kind of make yourself better so you can connect better with people around you and keeping the relationship in mind, I think it's a very small chance that you'll get to that place of selfishness.
Judy Berenson there speaking to Emma Nelson and hopefully curing you of your January blues. You only had to endure 27 days of them to get there. That's it for this edition of Sunday Brunch. It was produced by George McDonough. Our studio manager was Kenya Scarlett. Our researchers, Mirjana Glaster and Maylie Evans. Midori House session in just a moment. Blue Hawaii, the guest this week. A new Monocle Weekly coming up an hour from now. A news update in just a moment. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.